Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
We're kidding ourselves if we think people will stop talking.
You're one of the Monterey Five, right?
Monterey Five?
Just the way he said it, you know.
How did he say it?
Like the elf scarlet letters on our backs.
It's gonna get us. It's gonna get us all.
What are you talking about?
The lie.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Big Little Lies. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week on the show, we break down the latest episode of the HBO series Big Little Lies. This week, we will be speaking about season 2, episode 4, She Knows. Before we get into any of that, actually, Richard, who do you feel like the she and she knows is?
I think it's actually about Bonnie's mom.
Yeah, right? It's Elizabeth.
Yeah. I don't think it's about Mary Louise. I don't think it's about the detective because they've already known.
Exactly. They've been known. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. So that's my take too, as well. Usually we have an interview with someone from the show. This week we do not. Instead, what we have in its place is a bunch of great emails from you all. We got so many long, thoughtful emails, and that's no surprise, you know, when we're talking about a show that has so much to do with abuse and gaslighting and trauma and all this sort of stuff. A lot of our listeners have a lot to say, and I'm really glad you all wrote in. If you want to chime in, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. So we're going to talk about some emails throughout and also just sort of break down our thoughts about the latest episode. The first email I want to get to, though, has some bad news for Richard. And I don't know if someone's already tweeted this at you, Richard, but
mm-mm.
Esteban wrote in to let us know that, the ice cream flinging scene that you've so been looking forward to was actually cut from the final season.
I have to go. This has been fun, but I'll see you.
That's the whole reason we're doing the podcast, was to get to the ice cream. So, yeah, apparently, Meryl Streep revealed that in an interview that the ice cream didn't make it. So that's nice to know. I mean, like, I will say this. That's
kind
nice
of devastating.
It's nice to know. Here's my silver lining. We've been interrogating a little bit whether or not sometimes Big Little Lies indulges too much in the, like, over the top, ness, you know, specifically when we think about Laura Dern's character Renata and stuff like that. And so maybe isn't it nice to know that in season 2 they were like, okay, maybe maybe ice cream flinging is too Real Housewives and we don't want to do that. Do you know what I mean? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think in the broader context of the show, it absolutely makes sense. And, you know, especially because we were talking last week, or I was at least, and I think you agreed with me to some extent, that it was like maybe a little too. And I think, yeah, Madeline hurling a frozen treat at Meryl Streep might be a bridge too far.
I mean, a snow cone, maybe, but Sherry, no.
Ugh, yes. Ugh.
In this economy. So, okay. So, a more serious email I want to get to is from Sarah. We got actually a few emails from people saying that they think we don't fully grok sort of what Meryl Streep is doing as Mary Louise. Maybe some of the more insidious, behavior that we're not noting. So, Sarah pointed out, I think you guys undersold the degree to which Mary Louise is a potential malevolent figure. She's not overtly aggressive, no, and a mother trying to defend the memory of a dead child is something we tend to instinctively sympathize with as an audience. But under that mild grieving mother act, there have been a lot of red flags resembling classic signs of an abuser. She doesn't respect boundaries and constantly pushes at any lines set down by people around her, stalking Jane, rifling through Celeste's drawers, etc. She displays an ability to turn from warm to malicious when told no or challenged. And to my mind, worst of all, she consistently gaslights basically everyone she talks to, with a particular emphasis thus far on Celeste and Jane. I'm going to focus on the rape abuse denials for a second because she does something revealing I'm going to call the full Susan Collins. She doesn't come in guns blazing and call Jane or Celeste full-on liars. Instead, she says, it wasn't that bad, or maybe you're remembering it wrong, or what did you do in the lead-up? Could you have helped create the problem? It's subtler and uglier than more overt slut-shaming because she picks at them each slowly, sussing out their own deep-rooted fears. I don't think it's an accident we see Jane ask Celeste if she resents her for initiating things with Perry, to establish that something she worries about before Mary Louise brings up the same question, for example. And then Mary Louise uses it against them. This functions as gaslighting, another classic abuser technique, isolating victims in order to cut off support systems and the ability to get a reality check from someone outside the glare of the abuser's gaslight, so to speak. And then this is a great long email from Sarah, but Sarah goes on to mention another thing that Mary Louise does that I'll just sum up, which is something is a particular pet peeve of mine, in everyday conversation is when someone says, I was speaking to Jane, or I was speaking to Celeste, or I was speaking to whoever about you, and which ramps up your paranoia. And it's just like, it always hurts me personally when someone brings that up, because I'm like, listen, you can come to me with your problems, and if someone else has a problem with me, they can come to me with their problems. But I don't need you to say, I've got corroborating evidence from all these other people I've been talking to about you. I mean, that's an insight into my feelings about how to communicate with people. But what do you think of Sarah's... I think Sarah wrote this email before, obviously, seeing episode 4, and I think episode 4 just sort of supports her statement here in terms of Mary Louise's behavior. What do you think of this email, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I think episode 4 is really where, you know, because, you know, I guess maybe my hesitance was I wasn't really sure that I wanted the show to create a new villain. You know, in some ways I wanted it to live in a world that, I don't know, felt a little bit less absolute than that in a way. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, you know, I guess the way that Celeste and, I mean, felt about Perry last season, I guess you could sort of say that at least in her mind, there was not an absolute thing happening, but for us, certainly, I think there was. But in this episode, for sure, and I think that, you know, what is one classic abuser threat, leveled against very often women, is, you know, is taking away their children.
Yeah.
You know, if you dare to sort of name this thing, if you say you were abused, if you do this, then, well, that's it. And I'm going to get the kids, you know. And here we have it not being the abusive father of the children, but his mother. But she's employing the same tactic. And I think that to me was like, okay, this is where the show is headed with this. And also just other subtler things. I think I really appreciated more the nuances of Meryl Streep's performance in this episode than I had last week.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in Sarah's email, she goes on to predict that Mary Louise is going to try for custody, and she was right. So
there you go. Well done, Sarah.
And then we got another email from a listener, Ray, who wrote another great long email, but her sort of a additional assessment of the Mary Louise character is to say, her assessment is, when you see someone say, Perry's not, when you see Mary Louise say, Perry's not evil, he can't be evil, he's my good boy, he can't be evil, in Ray's mind, in this listener's mind, when someone says something like that, it means they know evil, have known evil, have defined evil somehow in their lives. And she was like, you know, could Perry's father have been an abuser? We get more info on Perry's father in this episode, but could Perry's father have been an abuser? Could Mary Louise have been abused? You know, these things are cyclical and generational. You know, does she have an experience with abusers that makes her feel like she understands what the definition of an abuser is and cannot reconcile that to her son? And like, what we may be discovering this episode is that Mary Louise herself is the abuser. We've been looking for this. Like, here we are, we're meeting the woman who, I don't know if it's fair to say this, but helped create Perry. So I feel like we've been on the lookout throughout of like, what can we read in her behavior that could help us understand how Perry grew up to be the person that he is, you know? Mm-hmm. And one thing that weirdly stuck out to me in this episode is when she comes to Madeline's house, when they're doing the pumpkin carving, and she comes in and, you know, she's doing the like, where are my grandsons? And she calls them her two soldiers. And there was just something like weirdly, you know, like, I don't know, no knock on our like military, but there was just something like weirdly martial about it that I was just like bristled at that particular nickname for two little boys, you know?
Well, you don't have to knock on the specific, you know, members of the military at the moment, but to sort of question the early militarization of young boys, you know, and sort of, suggesting that that is some sort of, some, you know, aspiration toward toughness and violence, is, you know, and it made me think about, you know, when we see Mary Louise in the first episode in the car, kind of instructing her two grandsons about what makes good men. And, you know, there was just a very, not just gendered, because she was specifically speaking about two boys, but, a sort of veneration of maleness over maybe, you know, I don't know that she would speak that way to a little girl. Right. Yeah, I think all of that is, you know, for a season that I think is not quite as subtle in other arenas, I'm appreciating the way that they are teasing out Mary Louise's psychology.
Yeah, absolutely. And we get some more of it, with the introduction of this new character played by Dennis O'Hare, who I was so excited to see because I love him so much. But we'll get to all of that.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
I wanted to get to a little thesis that I'm cooking on for this season, which is, and we'll have some more emails later on, but one thesis that I got out of this episode is my memory of season one, and I did rewatch it recently, is that when it comes to sort of the bad behavior of both the dads and moms of Monterey, the thesis of season one seemed to kind of be, these kids are preternaturally mature, which they are, you know, like Chloe and Ziggy and Amabella are all like, you know, very precocious, right? Mm-hmm. you know, and so it's like the parents are the kids and the kids are the parents, sort of like dichotomy or whatever. In this season, I feel like the emphasis is even more on these men are boys. And we get that, you know, we've seen that with Gordon, Renata's husband, with like all of his toys and his train set and like all of that sort of stuff in the season. But then in the scene with Ed and Nathan and at the party where they sort of start fighting and, you know, they've had this sort of like playground taunting, relationship throughout the whole series. But when I rewatched, this episode for the second time, seeing how that fight breaks out, which is Nathan pulling the wig down, and then when it gets broken up by the women, he keeps going, "We were just playing, we were just playing." It's like mm-hmm. two boys fighting at, you know, two little boys fighting at a party. So like,
yeah.
Do you feel like the show is making some kind of commentary in season two about, how women have to mother their husbands as much as their kids, or are the women as childish this season as the men, or what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's complicated. But I think there's an interesting parallel between what you're talking about, you know, vis-a-vis Ed and Nathan fighting and whatnot, and the scene with Madeline and Ed where they're, you know, out on their fabulous, we were talking about my favorite home
oh,
last
God.
Episode.
Yeah.
Like that like wonderful, comfortable outdoor living room, essentially. And, you know, they've kind of made up a little bit he's back in the house because, she said, it wasn't us, it was my problem. So she shoulders the blame for this fractured relationship. And yes, she's the one who stepped out, but like, that's often the symptom of something much, you know, deeper. And so he's, I guess, content for the time being enough with that, but also still wants to hold it over her a bit, again, petulantly. And then she's out there and she has this confrontation with her daughter, who made this kind of, you know, funny pun joke for school about her mom being unhinged for a class project. And, you know, Ed has been non-responsive about Madeline's idea to go up to Big Sur, or down to Big Sur, I don't know, geography up there, you know, to Big Sur to, you know, go to some sort of couples retreat thing. He's non-verbal about that. He just sort of, and I guess basically I think that they're drawing a comparison between the way that Madeline's daughter reacts to her and the way that Madeline's husband does. And so I think absolutely there you have that sort of thesis about the, I mean, I guess we talk a lot about emotional labor that women and families, have to kind of both shoulder and direct and, you know, placate and all that stuff. So while Madeline, you know, clearly has a difficult personality, which I know difficult is a loaded word when talking about women, but, you know, she can be hard to sort of, like in some senses, I think that we're seeing more the product of that, which is like that she's in a household where she's not really getting any help.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you see his removal there in the final scene that they have, or no, it's the penultimate because I think she tries to initiate sex after that. But in that scene they have where he's like, "I'm here, aren't I?" And she's like, "You are not here." And I think we can all agree with that. Like forever, whatever Madeline's faults may be, whatever mistakes she made, and she is like trying to some degree to own them. You know, the accusation that, you know, their therapist made last week of, you know, people step out, as you just said, people step out because of, you know, well, like often some sort of withholding or something like that. We see that so much more here from Ed than I remember seeing in season one, where he's just like, "I'm here." And she's like, physically being in the house is not the same as being here, by the way.
Yeah.
So,
and I also think that while Ed at the party, you know, and she's like, "Do you want to dance?" He's like, "Not in front of all these people." "Yeah, I want to dance with you, but not in front of all these people." And then he goes on this little mini monologue about how everyone's pretending. And it's like, yes. And I want to talk more about that party, later in this episode. And so Ed isn't exactly wrong, but it's also just like, oh, like cool insight, 14-year-old. Like, you know, everyone's a poser. Like, oh, okay. Like Holden Caulfield.
I was
like,
about to say, yeah. What a phony.
Yeah. Like calm down. So yeah, I think I really like Adam Scott's performance, in the show, particularly in this episode, because I think he's getting at something very sharp in how this guy is not a bad guy, but he's a lazy guy.
Yeah, I like that. It's interesting. And then he has this sort of like little vengeance, or I can't tell. Like, I actually kind of like the Bonnie Ed connection. And in season one, it felt like, It wasn't very pointed. There are ways in which in season two it does feel pointed on Ed's behalf to like get at Madeline, right? But there also it's just like Bonnie's always, it's nice to see Bonnie smile, I guess. So when she and Ed are dancing and fooling around, like then it's like cut to Nathan looking at her, cut to Madeline looking at them, you know, like cut to all of that. But it is kind of nice to see these two characters who have gone through some shit, like have a nice moment. I don't know. It's complicated, you know? Should we talk about Elizabeth in this episode? Is it too early to talk about that?
No.
Oh, well,
I mean, she knows.
Yeah, she knows. Well, really quickly before that, the other sort of male partner that we have, well, we should talk, Perry, in terms of this idea of like, men as boys, like Perry in season one, and I talked about this earlier, in this podcast season, like one of my favorite things they did in season one was that whole like monster routine that he used to do. Mm-hmm. But one of the like seen as a good aspect of Perry was how he was able to get on his boys' level. You know what I mean? And play with them. That was like, that was the good side of Perry, allegedly. But like, you know, it takes on a different, you know, you could take it in a different light, when viewed with his other men of like this, he wasn't a father to them. He was a pal. You know,
right.
Sort of thing.
And isn't that always the privilege, or not always, but often the privilege of yeah. men in heterosexual families where, yeah, they, you know, mom has to be the disciplinarian, the organizer, the planner, the scheduler, the, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the dad can kind of swoop in, honestly, a pretty hackneyed. I mean, I think that the monster thing was like interesting in the context of the show, but like, it wasn't like he wasn't fucking Fred Rogers, you know, he was like, you know, and also this whole thing in this episode with Mary Louise being like, it's the best pizza in the world. Like, oh, cool. Perry said that pizza was good. Like, what a great dad, you know?
Perry knows how to stretch the cheese. And I'm like, we all know how to stretch cheese. It's okay.
Amazing. You know, and I think that, like, I think the show is being smart about that, where, like, you watch Mary Louise venerate him, and she can do it because those kids are young. And kids are impressed by small things, you know what I mean? And it just seems to, like, to lock into their minds, or to try to lock into their minds, like the goodness of their father, the innate specialness of him based on small sort of common parental things is very telling.
Absolutely. I, and then the last, fella we should maybe talk about is Corey, who's like such a sweet little aquarium angel. You know, I did like the moment when Renata and Bonnie are both just like, oh my God, he's so cute. What, who is this cute boy you brought to this party?
Laura yeah. Dern playing the energy of a hostess greeting people at a loud party was so perfectly done.
Yeah.
And also chilling because I saw a little bit of myself in it. And I was like, oh my God, was that what I was like at my birthday party? Like, just kind of like, everything's fabulous. Hi. Oh my God. You know, like it was just like a brilliant piece of acting and writing. And yeah, the
and
whole
like
thing
improvisation,
about
improvisation, I think.
Oh, for sure. Just very naturalistic.
Yeah. Our guest last week, PJ Byrne, said that like Laura Dern is a huge improviser, which like that made me watch this episode. Like I was thinking the greeting scene is amazing, but also like the gift bag giveaway scene mm-hmm. where she's like, oh, this dress, it's yours. Like all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm, I'm like, mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Yeah. I love both of those bookends for sure. But Corey, is like a sweet boy in theory. Hopefully there's no like, we've talked about maybe like some questions, some potential minefields, but he seems right now to be like a sweet boy in the vein of like Ziggy, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. but still very boyish. So that's sort
of. Yeah. And I liked, I mean, for one thing, to use a 70s term to describe this, you know, with his like open collar and teased up hair, he looked like a stone fox. Like, he looked really good. Uh-huh. But I like the scene outside when he goes to talk to Jane and, you know, he's like, we don't have to talk about it. And she's like, I want to. You know, and I think that was her, I guess, pushing back a little bit about like, maybe a sort of over politeness or chivalry or something. Like I appreciated the sort of the sort of odd dynamic of that. And I guess, you know, Corey did say in an earlier episode, like, I'm weird or something. And maybe we're supposed to see that as something of a red flag, but, I don't know. I think the show has saddled Jane with enough, you know, bad male energy that maybe they're trying to give her another side of that, you know, yeah. And I hope so anyway.
It would be nice to have one, like, example of a nice male partner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, all right. So, let us get back to Elizabeth and what she knows. What does she know and when does she know it? So Elizabeth throughout is sort of like stalking around this party, going like, I got bad energy from this room. In between her like amazing dance moves, she's like observing people, observing things and having these flashes. And then she has this, stroke and goes into the hospital. And then we see her see something, which we can talk about. What do you feel about Elizabeth and what she knows here?
I liked the moment at the party where she and Bonnie are dancing and she's, you know, off. And I like that she was having fun at the party, you know, that she wasn't all just like, I'm here to, you know, prophesy doom. Like she was just, you know, having fun connecting with her daughter. And, you know, she kind of cups her face and it's a sweet moment. And then it turns into something else where she was sort of maybe trying to like read her. And I don't mean like in the Paris is Burning Kiki Pose way of reading somebody, but I mean like psychically, like me and Bonnie reacted in such a way that you're like, oh, this has definitely happened before. And I wonder if in some ways her reaction to it, I think it's complicated because I think she, in some ways she does believe that it's true, but would mostly say, oh no, it's not, you know, even though she is pretty, you know, woo woo and crunchy herself. Like, I like that little shiver and then later bigger shiver of the almost supernatural in there, you know,
yeah.
I think it was an interesting detail to have Bonnie be a little afraid of it.
Yeah, and this is something that when I interviewed Crystal Fox in an earlier episode of this podcast, who plays Elizabeth, she sort of said something that made me feel like we are supposed to take her visions maybe a little bit more seriously than I was initially, just because of my own, like, supernatural prejudices or whatever. Like, when Bonnie's like, none of this crystal stuff in my house, I was like, yeah, get that vision stuff out of here. But then, like, you know, we see her see things. We've seen her. She's talked about this drowning motif. But, like, do you think what we're seeing is her seeing Bonnie metaphorically drowning in the lies, blah, blah, blah? Or because the shot at the end, I have a couple thoughts about the shot at the end. The shot at the end is of Zoe Kravitz, right? She's in like a black zipped up hoodie and jeans. But I have three possibilities for what we're seeing. Are we seeing the future? Like, is Bonnie going to die either by suicide or something else? You know, is she going to die drowning? Is this a metaphorical, like, you're drowning in your lies and it's going to kill you, the guilt's going to kill you? Or are we seeing a memory of something that might have happened to, like, teenage Bonnie? Because we get screeners, but they're not like sharp, sharp quality. So I like freeze framed it, but I couldn't, see how young Zoe Kravitz, but Zoe Kravitz could get away with looking like quite young, you know?
And she was playing teenagers like 2 years ago.
Right. Like, and so like with the zipped up hoodie and the jeans, it just doesn't look like what Bonnie wears now. And so I was almost wondering, like, are we seeing a flashback? And we've seen these like little hints that Elizabeth, when she was drinking more and Bonnie was younger, was abusive to her daughter, at least somewhat. And potentially. And so, you know, was she involved in some kind of accident with Bonnie where Bonnie wound up like dangerously underwater as a teen? These are my three thoughts.
Yeah.
Do you have any other thoughts or any inclination one way or another?
Well, I mean, first of all, when you say you have something of a supernatural bias, do you mean that you're more of like a Dean Winchester girl or a Sam?
Whichever one whips their shirt off more, that's the one that I'm here for.
Because I know that's there's a contentious debate still about that. I agree with everything you said. I think the fact that she has a stroke while... Or she had a stroke, and I guess that was then she had an epileptic fit or something, or a seizure. That while sort of connecting to Bonnie's trauma or tragedy or secret or whatever, however you, Elizabeth sees it, I feel like adds more just weight to Bonnie's sense of guilt and, you know, everything like that. And so I appreciated this sort of the mystic kind of connection between those two things. I hope that Elizabeth comes back, you know, because I think she's a really interesting character played so well by Crystal Fox. But in another way, I wouldn't mind if Bonnie's past was left a little sort of tantalizingly unknown, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We only have a few more episodes left. We have, I guess, three more, right?
Yeah.
So who knows how much is going to come, but, clearly this is just another, mile on the road toward Bonnie having some kind of break in some, either good or bad.
Yeah, one of the theories that we got from a listener was like that in that listener email from Ray that I read earlier, a bit of that Perry's father was not only like abusive, but maybe like killed his brother, and then mm-hmm. Mary Louise killed him, and like that just went down a path where I'm like, I don't think we have time for that. I don't think we have the time for a revelation that Perry's father, and plus I felt convinced by what Mary Louise said in this episode about what happened to Perry's father. So like, I'm mindful of the fact that we're four episodes into a seven episode season, and there are some things that I just don't feel like we have time for. I feel like we could have time for Bonnie's full history, but I agree with you that I don't know if I want it. I want it if it gives Zoe Kravitz something more meaty to play, because I've really enjoyed every single thing that she's done this season. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't mind more and deeper and further for her. But I think maybe we can get flashes of it without literalizing it, making it even more literal, I guess, than it already is, and have it inform what it, maybe the unraveling. If someone is going to break in this uneasy alliance between four women, am I counting incorrectly? Five women. It's either going to be Celeste or Bonnie. Those feel like the weakest links, right? Women here. And, you know, Bonnie seems the most likely given her guilt. I mean, we saw that in this episode when Celeste and Bonnie are talking at the party and Madeline comes up and they're like, you made us lie. And now we're drowning in our lives. So that was a great scene too. I mean, Reese's.
Well, the whole party scene, you know, it does feel a little bit like chum for the fans. You know, you liked them in the Breakfast at Tiffany or the Audrey Hepburn costumes last year. And now here they are in Disco Fabulous. And apparently everyone in this town, Monterey, must have like 18 different costume shops, because like there's enough to go around for everybody.
The day before, Jane's like, I'm not sure if it's costumes or not, to like, right. And then, Corey, when they're surfing, and then voila, there's a Ziggy Stardust costume, like, and
elaborate wigs and everything. Yeah. And I like the joke of it, where, you know, what kid in 2019 is like into anything related to disco? That said, I remember when I was a kid, when I was in like third grade, I went to a private school for 2 years before my parents were like, oh, we can't afford this. There was a sock hop, like a 50s sock hop in the gym for like the third and fourth graders or something. And it was at like in the evening. So it felt like kind of a thing. And I'm looking back, it's like, that was probably more so the parents who were all born in the 50s could like, you know, dress their kids up in funny outfits. And I think this was the same thing, where it's like, sure, you know, talking about how the men are kids. Like, here's everyone being a kid, because they're the ones getting excited about this party and dressing up and whatever. And it's supposed to be for the little ones, you know. Do the little ones know who the band playing, you know, was? And I don't know. I just think it's such a funny, it's a little obvious maybe to have another fabulous party on Big Little Lies. That's also a very sort of silly and telling party, but, I don't mind it when you get Reese Witherspoon and like, you know, teased out hair like that.
Oh, so good. The tramps, who knew? Yes. The Monterey costume shops doing their finest work. But then like Renata somehow got a costume, like a mother daughter costume. And that's next level, Renata.
Mm-hmm.
Good job, you. Yeah, it's, at least they didn't like end it with another party. Do you know what I mean? At least they put it mid season. So it's not like quite exactly the same as season one, but, I take your meaning.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. What else do I want to talk about? Well, let's talk about, Celeste and the hot bartender and the Indian and all of that. By the way, when that guy showed up, like just to take their drink order, I was like, that guy's doing more than just taking drink orders. Like, they cast that guy, you know, I mean, he looks a little like Perry, right? He's a tall, Nordic looking man who looks like a little Sarsgaardy and stuff like that. But, like I don't know that I pegged it immediately for Celeste. I was like, is this another point of interest for Jane or something like that? And then I was like, nope, that's not where that went.
Yeah. And I liked the subtle, I keep saying subtle on this episode, but I liked the way that they you know, she says goodbye to Jane because she's like, no, I'm done. And then she's kind of just sitting there and the bartender walks up and is like, so what's going to be? And she's like, yeah, might as well. And then that's all we see of that until the next morning. You know, I think I like that they didn't double down on showing us Celeste having another sort of fraught sexual encounter. You know, I think it was efficient and telling, you know, sort of like writing, I guess.
Right. And they flash to it and they flash to like her sort of confusing images of him with images of Perry and stuff like
right.
that.
But like that was it, you know, otherwise it wasn't like immediate and
explicit,
sort of
explicit. Yeah. And the benefit of that is that when you cut to the next morning and Mary Louise comes in, if you're not like me and a deeply suspicious person, maybe you don't expect him to walk out of frame with naked or with his shirt off. I was like waiting for him. I'm like, he's there. It's going to be bad. And he was, but, Nicole Kidman played this, zonked out, so confused, version of Celeste, which she's, you know, she's done a little bit before, but like so well. Like it's just, I don't think it's over the top. I think it's just like someone through a fog trying. Richard and I both have a bit of a theater background, which is why we are stars of stage and screen right now. And, I remember, and I don't know if this is a bad acting note. Please write it if you're a professional actor and you're like, why don't give people this note? But like the number one note an acting teacher once gave me about acting drunk is like, you're trying so hard to act normal. Like when you're drunk, you're trying so hard. You're like, I'm fine. This is fine. I can walk. Mm-hmm. I can talk. This is fine. And that sort of scene, and that is like, once I got that acting note, like you do realize that sometimes, or I do anyway, when I've had like a little too much to drink and I'm like, oh God, I'm trying so hard to talk normally right now. This is so bad. So that's what Celeste, you know, that I feel like is sort of what Nicole Kidman was playing in that scene where she's just like, I'm just drinking my coffee. This is fine. Yeah. My eyes are open. I'm fine. This is fine. I'm here, you know, sort of thing.
And I thought it was a terrifying scene, you know, because, I've been on both sides of that where, you know, you had a too late a night out and you wake up and you're like, well, I'm still not okay, you know? And then also when you go to meet someone somewhere or whatever, and you realize that they're in a sort of not great state, you know, and there's such a feeling of concern and revulsion. And, you know, if you're the person bearing witness to it, and then if you're that person, a shame and a sort of like panic. And I just think that like the way they did that was so, credible, you know,
yeah.
And even though, you know, we're sort of seeing the rise of Mary Louise as a villain here, there is a concern there. I mean, not that, you know, like Madeline said, like, you're entitled to a private life, blah, blah, blah. She should have called you. It was too early in the morning, you know. Sure. Yes, that's all fair. And Celeste is certainly entitled to that. But like, yeah, I mean, if you're the kid's grandmother and you come home with them and here's a strange man in the house and she's all zonked out, like, yeah, that's a worry.
Like taking the kids out of the equation, Celeste, who has survived, like I have no issue with Celeste being like, you know, a sexual person as soon as she wants to be a sexual person. That's mm-hmm. not the issue. The issue is like when she tells Madeline, I wasn't even aware he was in the house. What I mean?
Yeah.
And then you're like, even without kids, this is a person who's not doing, exhibiting healthy behavior around this sexual encounter. So. And then, yeah, so then when Mary Louise has this conversation later with Jane, and Jane comes in sort of like righteously defending her friend and then is a little like, oh, on the one hand, I don't want to forget like the wise emails we got about Mary Louise being an expert gaslighter and all this sort of stuff. But on the other hand, like she does have a few fine points there. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think she's going about any of this correctly when it comes to Celeste at all. But she's not incorrect to tell Jane, like, you know, Celeste crashed her car. So, yeah, do you want Ziggy in the car with Celeste? I don't know, you know?
Well, yeah, and those are the material things. But I think that also what Mary Louise is doing in other ways with this kind of concern trolling, this sort of fake pity, you know, and demanding that every feeling Celeste feels is grief, that it can't possibly be anything else. It's just grief. You need time to heal. And it's like, no, there's more there. It's not, it's a relief that he's gone. It's a fear. It's a lot of things. And yes, grief is part of it, but it's not the whole story. And Celeste keeps, or Mary Louise keeps insisting that it is. And, you know, just kind of, you know, when there's that incredible scene where Celeste slaps Mary Louise, and her glasses fall off, which I always instinctually feel bad for the person who's just had their glasses knocked off, even if they're a bad person. Cause I'm just like, I'm like, oh no, their glasses. I think about like My Girl and, you know, whatever.
Thomas J.
He needs his glasses.
I can't see him.
You know, and then Mary Louise immediately recenters like some sort of creature where she just like goes, snaps right back and is like, no, it's, you know, that's just, you know, just, and it's this really menacingly imperious kind of tone that, well, A, we know Meryl Streep is good at that, but B, further drives home in this episode that this is a woman with a lot of malintent, I think. And
well, yeah, she baited her into that slap.
Yeah,
she was needling her. Like, she comes into Madeline, like, I really wish Madeline had just closed the door in her face. You know what I mean? And I kind of understand why, like, it makes sense to me that Madeline, like, ever wanting to seem the chipper hostess, like, would invite her in and roll her eyes at her behind her back and stuff like that. But I really wish it was so intrusive. And yeah, so this is to support these emails we got. This is Mary Louise not respecting boundaries, needling Celeste, provoking Celeste into an attack, and then being like, my, temper, 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 sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What would we call that? Foreplay. And all the while, we talked about, a lot has been made about that the sort of stage business that Meryl Streep does with her crucifix earlier in the season, where she like sort of pulls it on her chin, when she was talking to Madeline. This stage business with her glasses, where she's just like looking at her glasses, you know, like it's such good, work. You know what I mean? Because she's doing something very big while keeping it very small. And that's just, I don't know if you've heard, but Meryl Streep is a good actress. So.
Yeah. You know who was also a good actor is Dennis O'Hare, who,
yes!
has, you know, that great scene in the lawyer's office where he's basically just like, you know, he tells her this thing. We've seen a lot of movies and TV where if you talk to a lawyer, the other party can't, you know, retain them. And she's like, oh, and you're like, wait, does Mary Louise actually think that's, cause I think in that scene, she's in some ways deciding like, okay, how far do I actually want to take this?
Yeah.
You know, and then obviously she decides what she decides, but it's just funny watching her have that moment. And then Dennis O'Hare, forgive me, I forget the character's name. Be like kind of settle back in his chair and be like, look, this is not pretty. If you want this to be done, like, I understand that it might seem extreme, but, so I, you know, again, I appreciated that the show wasn't being super absolutist about people's motivations, you know? It was a little more complicated than for Mary Louise in that scene, I think. Maybe I'm giving her too much credit.
Yeah, no, I think it was. His character's name is Ira Farber. And Dennis O'Hare showing up in this. So, great actor of stage and largely TV, I think, more than film. But Dennis O'Hare has been sort of, in what I would consider, forgive me, American Horror Story purgatory, where like, you know, he's been like a Ryan Murphy regular, and that means he's been in a lot of projects that I haven't been that interested in lately in later seasons. And so I've missed him. He's on The Good Fight sometimes, you know, he's on This Is Up Us, which is another show that I don't watch. But like when he showed up here with his beautiful voice, I was just like, yes, bring Dennis O'Hare into this. I want it. So I don't know, like, what else he's going to be doing. But the question I have is, like, something that was a big, really fun point of season one was what a good lawyer Celeste is. And, like, obviously, I don't know, obviously, in movies and TV, judges always advise against representing yourself. But, like, Celeste seems suddenly in such, like, a hapless... And I know she's dealing with a lot of trauma. She's like dealing with how she's medicating that trauma, all that sort of stuff. But when she gets served and she just goes like, no, and drops it, that's a fine reaction. But then we cut to Renata talking to Madeline about like which lawyer she's getting her. And I'm like, isn't she a freaking legal shark? Does she not have sharky lawyer friends from elsewhere that she can call? Like, why is Renata having to find a lawyer for Celeste? Like, that's, you know, that's a question.
That's a good point. Yeah. And it's, you know, I had sort of forgotten the lawyer plotline on first season, which is, you know, my bad, but also maybe the fault of the show for not kind of reminding us this season. I don't know. Maybe they'll get to that. Maybe she'll kind of collect herself and be like, oh, wait, I know how to fight this. But
oh my God. Fingers now crossed for a huge Nicole Kidman standing up in court.
That would be quite something.
Burning but, the house down. Yeah.
With regard to Dennis O'Hare, I like to think that, you know, they were like, okay, so Meryl, we have the scene with this lawyer. We're just going to get like a local actor. And she was like, no, I want Dennis O'Hare. And they called. He was like, yes, oh, right away, of course. She just summoned him.
I feel like I've talked about this probably on this podcast before, but I always think of that scene in Wayne's World where they like replace the random gas station attendant with Charlton Heston. It's like, this guy's fine, but can we get Dennis O'Hare? Thanks so much.
Totally.
But yeah, I mean, I would love a Dennis O'Hare versus Nicole Kidman. If this show just turns into that legal drama, I'd be okay with it. So yeah, so that is all of that. Is there anything that we, oh, well, okay. So I want to circle back to something you mentioned before, tying in your reference to Catcher in the Rye and also, your heady private school days. We got someone writing in asking us if we thought maybe, they were going for something a little Donna Tartt-esque, in this second season, The Secret History, which is, I think, Donna Tartt's superior novel. There's first a killing, spontaneous and not completely devastating. Then the Secret of the First unwinds the players involved and the group ends up killing one of its own, spoiler for The Secret History, whoever is likely to implicate the others. This is the second murder. Could the killed be Mary Louise, Bonnie? Just a thought. Do you feel like the tone of season two, Big Little Lies, is one that feels like, I mean, we're seeing the unraveling of the players. That's true. But do you feel like we're headed towards another murder or possibly a suicide, as we sort of indicated with Bonnie?
No.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I think we're headed toward a defeat. And I don't mean for our main characters. I think they are going to defeat something. And it might have compromise bloated into it, much as it did last season. But I don't see David E. Kelly and Leanne Moriarty playing the same trick sort of twice.
Yeah, I agree.
But maybe I'm wrong. I mean, you know, I think I've been a little up and down on this season. I really thought this episode was strong after the third episode, which kind of lost me a little bit. But to the show's credit, in a way, I really have no idea where they're headed. That's kind of the fun of it. But yeah, I just, for whatever reason, call me, you know, Elizabeth cupping the face of the show and seeing something, but I don't see a murder specifically now.
Too far out there take, on this season, came when I was watching the party and they played Disco Inferno. And it's just Burn, Baby, Burn is sort of like playing behind them as they talk. And I've been watching too many episodes of Lost, I think, but I'm like, what if they're dead the whole time? And this is their purgatory and they're just being punished for their crimes and stuff like that. That's also not what this show is, but wouldn't it be amazing if the devil came out at the end and was like, you've been punished this whole time. Who would play the devil on Big Little Lies, Richard?
B.B. Newworth.
Great. Nailed it. Damn Yankees. Anyway, all right. So, last thing I want to talk about, email wise that we got a lot of people who have a lot of opinions about our opinions of Robin Wiegert's, therapist character. And, you know, you and I have been sort of going back and forth on like how either realistic or effective we think her methodology is. And we had a lot of people push back on us, and actually some therapists write in and say, like, there are therapists who, like, do push their patients in this way. It can be effective depending on the patient. The thing that they did agree with us, seemingly agree on with us about is that for a first meeting with Ed and, Madeline, an intake session, as it were, it was, her tactics were perhaps way too aggressive for that. Like the way in which she pushes Celeste, some people like don't seem to have a problem with that, but the way in which she treats Ed and Madeline for their first lesson, and Madeline seemed to agree because she's like, let's go to Big Sur, it's got to be better than that woman.
That, I thought that was really funny, and it just was like, well, that's the thing is like, and I think that one of the most electrifying things about the first season was watching those therapy sessions tease out what was really happening with Celeste and Perry. You know, it wasn't a right away kind of thing. When she's talking to Celeste in this season, like, they have context. There's time, you know, they have spent time together, and so her tactics might make more clinical sense, for them than it does for her to go right into Ed and Madeline and their sort of fractured psychology or whatever. That said, you know, either way, I still want Robin Weigert on the show. I like those scenes, even if she's, you know, not always the best therapist.
Great actress, mm-hmm. not always the best therapist. All right, here's my last question to you before we head out. We see Renata and Madeline having a little meal. We see the investigator, at the hospital and at their brunch or whatever. She's sort of just here on the fringes, circling, watching, waiting to pounce. Madeline and Renata are eating avocado toast and mixed berries.
Looked good.
Which is like just sort of the most California brunch I can think of. What would be your brunch that you would have in Monterey, Richard?
I mean, that looked pretty good, I gotta say. But my favorite actress in the world told me that it's the best pizza ever, so I think I'd have to go for that.
You'd have to like pull the cheese.
I didn't know you could do that.
Who knew? They should make it in like string form or something. I don't know.
Fried string form.
Yes. All right. So, if you guys want to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, we really appreciate your emails and help us view the show, from different angles. But I'm with Richard here that like, I think this was a real strong chapter in our saga, and I'm excited to see where we go from here. Richard, when we come back next week, and next week's podcast might be a little later because it's unclear whether or not we'll have an advanced screener for the episode, so we might get it on the Monday or Tuesday, we'll see. But Richard, until then, where can people find you?
I'm going to be curled up on that outdoor couch that Ed and Madeline don't really seem to appreciate as much as they should be. It's so nice. And from that couch, I'll be writing for VF.com and tweeting at Rylos. Where will you be?
I will be hand sewing matching gold lamé gowns for Richard and I to wear for the rest of the podcasting season with sequin berets, and listening to the Tramps and writing on VF.com. Yeah.
Yeah. We should sort out our gift bag budget too. Goodie bag, yeah.
Yes.
I was thinking like $10,000 a bag, but we can work it. We can iron out the details.
Yeah. I've heard that there's a new color for the iPad, and I think we should, you know, really, really go for it. Get that new.
Perfect. a ultra, lilac gold or something.
Ultra rare rose gold. All right. We will see you all back in Monterey next week.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.